evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Denise Summers and I'm the Vice Principal. And on behalf of St John's College, I would like to welcome you all to tonight's proceedings. At this point, can I ask that all mobile phones be turned off or switched to silent? This year marks the 35th anniversary of St John's College. The college is proud of this achievement and the many thousands of students that has passed through its gates. These students have made significant contributions to society in the areas of medicine, law, science, education, commerce and business. It was with these thoughts in mind that the new board of directors decided that the celebrations this year should begin with a dedication to one of the teachers of St John's who was pivotal in the lives of so many past students. Santo Constanzo was a teacher at St John's for more than 25 years. From the school's early beginnings in Carlton through to its relocation in 1983 to this site in Preston. He retired from the school in 2008 due to ill health and passed away in September 2009 at the age of 50. And so you are here tonight at the inaugural annual Santo Costanzo Memorial Oration. The first two speakers will tell you about Santo Costanzo and what he meant to the college. Then our special guest, Mr. Julian Burnside, will deliver the oration, and finally His Grace, Bishop Jacobus, and the chair of the new board of directors will conclude, whereby tea and coffee will be served. Noting the large number of ex-students we have here tonight, I would also like to take this opportunity to announce the creation of the St John's College Alumni. A cocktail evening will be held on Saturday the 3rd of May to launch the group. A flyer is available with all the details in the foyer, and I encourage all ex-students to attend this event and become actively involved. Now to our first speaker. Mr. Bill Giarvis is a past school captain, class of 92 student, current board member, and when he's not here at the school, is a partner at Septus, Jones and Lee Solicitors. Could you please welcome Mr. Giarvis?
Thank you, Denise. Your Grace, Bishop Jacobus, Mr. Julian Burnside, family members of the late Santo Costanzo that are with us tonight, my fellow College Board of Directors, Dr. Harry Lavopoulos, our principal, St. John's leadership team and staff, current and former students of the college, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the new Board of Directors of St. John's Greek Orthodox College, I wish to welcome all of you to the inaugural annual Santo Costanzo Oration. It is a great honour for all of us here tonight to have the opportunity to listen to our key speaker, the prominent human rights lawyer and Queen's Counsel, Mr. Julian Burnside. It's an honour to hear him speak today about the state of human rights and the treatment of asylum seekers in Australia. Indeed, it is most fitting that it is Julian Burnside who will be delivering the inaugural annual Santo Costanzo Oration. Julian, it is a great honour to have you here, and we thank you for most graciously accepting to be here today. The subject matter of your oration is of paramount importance. It is imperative that we are reminded of the words of Martin Luther King, who believed that the ultimate tragedy is not the oppression and cruelty by the bad people, but the silence over that by the good people. After all, human dignity, human rights, natural law, and fundamental freedoms are universal entitlements and should be afforded to all humans irrespective of social status, gender, political beliefs, religion, or ethnic origins. My dear friends, today's event has been organised to remember, celebrate and honour the life of a legendary St. John's teacher, Mr. Santo Costanzo. Santo was born in Melbourne on the 4th of February in 1959 and passed away at the age of 50 on the 10th of September 2009. Santo was a teacher of St. John's for more than 25 years. His parents migrated from Italy to Australia in the early 50s, and Santo was always proud of his family and his Italian background. Santo studied law but found his calling in life as a teacher. He taught legal studies, mathematics, politics, and international relations. He had a true passion for social justice and education. He believed that people must use their knowledge to improve society, to help create a better and more equitable world. He believed that students must have a sense of community and a sense of compassion. According to Aristotle, teachers who educate children deserve more honour than the parents that produce them, for parents merely give life, whilst good teachers ensure a quality life. There are not many teachers that can be deserving of such accolade more than Santo Costanzo. Santo was a great teacher. He inspired hope. He ignited the imagination and instilled in his students a love of learning. As a teacher, he did not wish to create students in his own image, but rather to develop independent human beings who can create their own image. Santo did not impose. To the contrary, he awakened his students' own expectations and continuously spoke to them, and he poked them with a very sharp weapon called self-realization and truth. Under his mentorship, St. John's students would graduate not only with vast knowledge and academic excellence, but also with a heart and soul. Under his guidance, St. John's students would graduate with a sense of community and a sense of belonging, proud of their background. With his extraordinary help, St. John's evolved in an educational institution of excellence that is rewarding our society with hard-working, respectful and dedicated young men and women added to the fabric of our multicultural society. You only have to look around you here today to witness the quality of the numerous St. John's graduates. Our college produces students of exceptional character and caliber who over the years have made significant contributions to Australian society in various fields and professions. Santo Costanzo was a true leader of our college. As vice principal and head of ECE for numerous years, he epitomised the very essence of St. John's and is widely considered to be instrumental to the school's continued existence and success. He led both students and teaching staff by example and showed unparalleled commitment to the college and its students. He possessed passion, knowledge, experience, determination, humility, and a legendary wittiness and sense of humour. A fair shake of the sauce bottle is what he always demanded from his students. And to those that achieved that, a cherry ripe would often miraculously appear and be provided to them. While Santo Costanzo did not take well to criticism of his beloved Collingwood Football Club, he possessed a powerful spirit, a spirit that underlies the very fabric of St. John's and reflects the values of our college. Santo was passionate about St. John's, about the school's culture, history and traditions. I recall in one of our last conversations where he informed me that he felt obligated to stay at the school. He rightly believed that our school was special. Indeed, for most of us that had the opportunity and blessing to graduate from St. John's, it is special. The new board of directors recognised that at St. John's we are custodians of an excellent and proud tradition. This year, our college celebrates 30 years of educational excellence. Founded in 1979, our college is proud to be a leader, to be the first bilingual Greek-Australian day school established in Australia. Let's not forget, it is St. John's that served as a forerunner and a paradigm for all subsequently established Greek-Australian schools in Australia. Today, our college aims to continue to be an educational leader, to provide a liberal, classical education within a modern context to the wider community. Reason, spirituality, compassion, faith, hope, love, innovation, the pursuit of knowledge, and the arts, social justice, and civic responsibility are the principles that continue to guide and inspire us. We recognise that whilst our students have local roots, We are living in times of increased globalization and global awareness. Our students are encouraged to have both local and transnational dreams and aspirations, and our educational programs aim to meet the growing demands of a globalized world. We are blessed with incredibly dedicated staff that work endlessly and go above and beyond their teaching duties. Santo, the college, the new board of directors, former and current students, teachers, parents, and the wider St. John's Greek Orthodox community are obliged to you, and thank you for all that you have provided to our school. You touched many hearts, influenced many people, including your colleagues, students, and parents, including me. You were my teacher at St. John's, and I, like many hundreds of other students, benefit from your knowledge, guidance, friendship, love, care, and compassion. We owe much to you, and for that we will always remain indebted to you. It is said that a teacher affects eternity. He can never tell where his influence stops. Well, sir, please rest assured that your influence will continue for many decades to come. We thank you, and may you rest in peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Our next speaker is Nikki Furtius, who is a current Year 12 student of St. John's, whose family were a close friends of Santo.
Good evening, Your Grace, Mr. Julian Birdside, members of the board, ladies and gentlemen. As some of you may already know, my name is Nikki Fodius and I am a current Year 12 student at St. John's Greek Orthodox College. What you may not know is that the late Santo Costanzo was not only a magnificent teacher at the college, but someone who I looked up to throughout my entire childhood. Mr. Costanzo began teaching at the college in 1982 when my father, John Fodius, was a student. In 1990, he influenced my father to join him in teaching at St. John's, which was the best advice he gave him. Since then, he and my father became inseparable, and I was lucky enough to share a close bond with him as well. Ever since I was a little girl, I knew I could count on Mr. Costanzo, or as I called him, your Santo, for encouragement, support, and the patience which at times my dad lacked. When I began primary school at St. John's, I remember Mr. Costanzo walking me into my classroom on the very first day. As scared as I was, he managed to calm me down and reassure me that everything was going to be okay. I was even more fearful walking through the secondary school gates on my first day of Year 7, as I knew he would not be at the college to support me and give me the courage that I longed for. Yes, my dad was there, but Mr. Costanzo knew exactly how to make me see the positive side to everything. He had a charismatic nature which radiated onto everyone around him. He had a heart of gold, and his goal in life was to make people feel better. Another important goal of his was to extend his knowledge, not only in legal studies, but on life in general, to his students. He was the spirit and culture of St. John's College and community. His dedication, passion, and commitment was evident to all that had the pleasure of being taught by him. His impact has been made even clearer as I stand here, looking upon all the former students who gave up their time to commemorate his life and celebrate his everlasting presence this evening. From what I have heard, he was just as kind and funny in the classroom as he was outside of school. His teaching methodology was excellent, and his vast knowledge on political studies was combined with humour and with wit. He was not the type of teacher to recite blocks of information from a textbook, but rather used a more personal angle to stress his points, and it definitely worked, as no student finished Year 12 disappointed with his teachings. Furthermore, as VCE coordinator, he inspired, supported, and shared his wisdom with many students, advising them on suitable paths to a successful future. If students were confused about their career choices, their go-to person was Mr. Costanzo, who provided them with a shoulder to cry on in their time of need and never failed to present them with a solution to their issues. He always made them feel comfortable and valued. There are few people in this world who can make such an impact in life and in death on an entire community, let alone a group of students. He is the glue that bonds different generations of students, as they all had the honour of sharing his knowledge, experience, and love of learning. Mr. Costanzo once said, "I'm so proud to have called the college home for 25 years, and I know that St. John's will be in my heart forever." Despite the fact that he was of Italian background, St. John's College was his home. He aspired to have students enter the wider community proud of their history, culture, language and tradition, and add to the fabric of our multicultural society. Many of our students have gone on to achieve what they desired in all walks of life, and this is in no small way testimony to his dedication and commitment here at St. John's. His devotion and love for his students manifested through his continued involvement in their lives after high school. He kept in contact with many former students who remember their time and their relationship with Mr. Costanzo with warmth and with reverence. No higher accolade can be bestowed upon a teacher when they hear heartfelt feelings from former students about the positive impact they had on their lives. We definitely generate a family spirit here at St. John's, and seeing the children of former students attending the college and ensuring that the tradition of family continues had a lasting and positive effect on him. I would like to thank the new board of St. John's College, particularly Mr. Bill Jardris, who made this evening possible. I would also like to thank Mr. Costanzo's relatives who are attending this special occasion, as well as former students, parents, colleagues, and everybody else here tonight who gave up their evening to pay tribute to Mr. Costanzo. I am certain that Mr. Costanzo's drive to help the school succeed will continue to manifest in the current and future students at St. John's College, as he wanted nothing but the best for everyone around him. His compassion and love towards the community of St. John's deserves to be carried on, and this is evident by this tribute to him tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki. And now our guest speaker. Julian Burnside is a barrister, human rights and refugee advocate, and an author. He was admitted as a barrister of the Supreme Court of Victoria in 1976 and appointed as Queen's Counsel in 1989. His work has always focused primarily on commercial law, and he has appeared in many significant commercial cases, representing Alan Bond, Rose Porteous, amongst many others. From the late 1990s, he began to undertake more and more pro bono legal work on a range of human rights-related issues. He was senior counsel representing Victoria Chief Civil Liberties Organisation in an action against the Australian government over the Tampa affair. In 2004, Mr. Burnside was awarded the Human Rights Law Award for his pro bono legal work for asylum seekers and for his work in establishing spare lawyers for refugees. Also in 2004, he was elected and named an Australian Living Treasure. In 2007, he received the Australian Peace Prize from the Peace Organisation of Australia. In 2009, he received an Officer of the Order of Australia for services as a human rights advocate and for his services to the arts and the law. Mr. Burnside has also written several successful publications on law, human rights and philology. In addition to his work in the law, he is a patron of numerous arts organisations. He regularly commissions classical music compositions and sculptures, and he is a chair of two arts organisations. Tonight, we are very fortunate to have him speak here at St. John's College. The topic of his speech is human rights in Australia. Is this who we really are? Please put your hands together to welcome Julian Burnside.
Thank you. Your Grace, members of Santo Costanzo's family, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very grateful to have been invited here today. It occurred to me, especially hearing Nikki speak, it's a rare thing for a teacher to leave such a mark on anyone that a student who only had a relatively few years' exposure to them will nevertheless speak so eloquently about them. In fact, it's a rare thing for any person to leave such a mark on a generation. Nikki said that there are few people in the world who can have such an impact as a teacher like Santo Costanzo, and that is an observation that really needs to be taken at full value. I think any of us in this room would be grateful say a few things about Santo Costanzo, because I thought I'd better know something about him before I came along and got up on my hind legs. But a great deal has already been said. But two things did strike me. When he died, the Herald Sun published a number of tributes to him, one from the class of 1992. And their tribute was, "Santo, dear sir, you touch us all with your love and grace. You were a true educator who at all times went far beyond your duty to help your students progress, but most importantly to become better human beings. The class of 92 will never forget you. You inspired every single one of us, and for this we're eternally grateful to you. May you rest in peace." That's a remarkable tribute. That's a tribute that anyone would be honoured to think that they might receive on their death. But the other one that also struck me, as it turns out, was part of the eulogy given by Nicky's father. And amongst other things, he said, "You used to comfort and reassure students in their time of need by providing them with a shoulder to cry on while showing them respect in the process. I remember when students said to you that they had no idea what career path to choose, and you always said, 'That's okay, that's perfectly normal, let's look at the options.' You always made them feel comfortable and valued." And then he went on to say, "During this past week I've had countless calls from former students dating back to 1982 from all over the world and all walks of life. You were their mentor, and they will never forget their memories of you. Your dedication to St. John's College was second to none. You were St. John's." It's a great tribute to a teacher. It's a great tribute to a human being. And I should also say it's a great thing that the school has instituted an annual oration to honour the memory of Santo Costanzo. It speaks well not only of him but also of the school. Most teachers, when they go, are lucky to get a watch to say thanks. This way, with luck, the values that Santo Costanzo stood for will be passed on year after year to successive generations of members of this school. All I can do tonight is hope to do justice to his memory, having never, of course, met him myself. But I mention these things about him because he obviously, from everything I've heard and read about him, stands as an example that we judge a person's character by their conduct, by what they do. People remember Santo Costanzo for the way he treated them, for his generosity of spirit, for his kindness, for his understanding, and so on. But we also judge a country's character by its conduct. And I think it's worthwhile, and my purpose tonight is to try and point to some aspects of Australia's conduct in order to see if it reflects on the character of this country. In saying that, I come to the rather unhappy conclusion that we're not doing terribly well. It's interesting to be saying it to a group of people at a Greek Orthodox school because the pattern of conduct that we've seen exhibited towards refugees in the last 15 years is eerily reminiscent of what I remember when I was growing up in Melbourne in the 1950s. In the 1950s in Melbourne and other cities in Australia, there was a continuing wave of arrivals from Southern Europe, especially from Italy and Greece. These were people fleeing the aftermath of the Second World War, fleeing the wreckage that was left after that conflict. And they arrived in Australia in historically very large numbers. It's worth remembering that when the Second World War ended, I think Australia's population was something like 4 million people. Now it's 23 million. So you had a large number of people coming from especially Italy and Greece and making their new home in Australia. And I can remember people of my parents' generation muttering darkly about these new arrivals, saying, "Oh, you know, they're too religious and they have too many children and the women dress all in black and they don't mix in and they eat awful food. Their food, oh, I mean, imagine having coffee with froth on the top. Imagine eating squid." I remember growing up as a kid being told to eat squid was about the most uncivilized possible thing to do. Now, of course, it's terribly fashionable and expensive. But what is interesting is that in a Australia in the last 15 years, we've heard very similar complaints about refugees who arrive here. And what we've forgotten is the immense benefit that Australian society has gained from the arrival of Italian and Greek migrants, especially since the end of the Second World War. I can think of very few people indeed who would want to turn back the clock and return to the narrow, cramped society which we had in Australia in the 1950s. The fact is that people who come to this country from other countries tend to do great things for this country. It has been our history. And yet, somehow we managed to keep on forgetting it. So perhaps this audience might remind others who've forgotten just how much this country can benefit from people who come here from other places. Now let me talk a little bit about refugees specifically. We have been very strange in our attitude to refugees in the last 15 years. Australia's record in refugees actually has not been all that bad until recent times. In the aftermath of the Second World War, we shifted our attitude to refugees fairly significantly, although it did take some time. At the end of the Vietnam War, or as the Vietnamese call it, the American War, a large number of people were displaced from Vietnam and also from Cambodia as a result of the genocide there. So in the late 1970s, there were a lot of Indochinese refugees on the move. And in the late 70s, when Malcolm Fraser headed a Liberal National Party government, he persuaded the then leader of the Labour opposition, Gough Whitlam, to adopt a united approach to receiving refugees from Indochina. And so instead of making a political plaything out of it, the government was able to bring into Australia about 25,000 Indochinese boat people each year for 3 or 4 years. A remarkable achievement, given that Australia's economy was weaker then than it is now, Australia's population was smaller then than it is now, and yet, with almost no social disturbance, we managed to welcome nearly 100,000 Indochinese refugees over the course of a few years. The other thing that I want to say about Australia's history in relation to refugees is this. There are, and most people don't know this, there are three strands of refugees who come into Australia, three streams of refugees who come into Australia. The first come as part of our offshore resettlement scheme. That's a scheme which not all countries have, where we say we will take a number of refugees from countries overseas every year. For a number of years, the quota has been 13,750. And how it works is that people from Australia go to refugee camps in other countries and they handpick refugees and bring them to Australia, accepted as refugees, and resettle them in the country. It's not entirely as selfless as it sounds. John Menadue, who used to be the Secretary of the Department of Immigration, tells a story against himself. He went, during the Malcolm Fraser years, he went to a refugee camp in Africa, I think. And he said to the person leaving the camp, "Have you got any doctors or engineers?" And the person leaving the camp looked at him ruefully and said, "Sorry, we've only got widows and orphans." The point, of course, is that you don't handpick the refugees who you help. You help them because they need the help. So anyway, our offshore resettlement system is a good system and we should be proud of it. And it's a great thing that we have it. The second stream of refugees or refugee applicants are those who come in by aeroplane. Now, to be able to come to Australia by aeroplane and claim asylum involves a couple of preconditions. The first is you've got to come from a country that is willing to give you travel documents, like a visa, for example. If you come from Iran right now and you go to the government and ask for a visa, for a passport, they will very likely arrest you, because asking for a passport is an indication to them that you want to leave the country, therefore you're dissatisfied, therefore you're an enemy of the state, therefore you'll be arrested. So getting a passport from some governments is quite difficult if you are amongst the minority who they're oppressing. The second thing you have to get is a visa to come to Australia, because can't get on a plane to come to Australia unless you've got a right to enter Australia. You'll need a passport, you'll need a visa, or if you're an Australian citizen and you've done this, you know that you have to show your passport at the other end in order to be able to get on the plane. And the reason for that is that if an airline brings a person to Australia who's not legally entitled to enter Australia, then that person is turned around, put back on the plane and sent back to where they came from at the expense of the airline. That's why the airlines are fairly particular, to make sure that people have the right travel documents. So unless you've got a visa from your country, plus a passport from your country and an Australian visa, you will not be able to get on a plane to come to Australia. It doesn't matter how much money you've got, you just won't be allowed to board. Now, a lot of people do come to Australia with travel papers and an Australian visa, and typically they come for business reasons, for tourism, for study, or things of that sort. And when they've cleared immigration control, they then apply for a protection visa. The visas they come in on are typically short-term, 3 months, 6 months, that sort of thing. And when that visa runs out, they're given a bridging visa by the government, and they're allowed to remain in the community for the whole time it takes to process their claim for protection. They're not vilified, they're not pointed at, they're not mistreated, they're not sent to Nauru or Manus Island, they're not put in detention, they are allowed to continue living in the community. And that may be for years. As it happens, when the assessment process is complete, only about 40% or fewer of them turn out to be refugees legally entitled to our protection, and the rest have to be removed. So that's the second stream. They're people who come with papers, but most of them turn out not to be actual refugees. The third group are boat people, who've been the focus of unwelcome attention and vilification over the last 15 years at least. They are people who are not able to get travel papers from their own government. They're people who are not able to get an Australian visa for whatever practical or political reasons, but they flee their countries of origin, and typically they have come down over the last 15 or 20 years. They've typically come from countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, down through Malaysia to Indonesia, and Malaysia and Indonesia haven't signed the Refugees Convention, so they don't offer them protection. So when they get to Indonesia, they bump into the water, and that's the end of their travel, and unless they can get on a boat. Now, the problem with being in Indonesia, if you're a refugee from Afghanistan, for example, the problem with being in Indonesia is that Indonesia hasn't signed the convention and will not give you protection. They'll allow you in with a one-month visa, but as soon as your one-month visa is up, you live in the shadows. If you're found, you'll be jailed. If you try to send your kids to school, you'll be found out and you'll all be jailed. If you try to get a job, you'll be found out and you'll be jailed. Now, you can go round to the UNHCR's office in Jakarta and apply for refugee status, and you'll be acknowledged by the UNHCR as a refugee, but that doesn't get you anywhere. All it means is that the UNHCR believes that you are a refugee. But then you'll have to wait until some country offers to resettle you. That may take 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. The resettlement time, on average, across the world's refugee population, the average refugee queuing up time is 190 years, which is not really useful, because by the end of 190 years, you're probably no longer available. Refugee resettlement. Now, there is only two things you can do. You can either decide to watch your children grow up without an education, hiding in the shadows for decades, or you can take your life in your hands and get on a boat. I wonder, is there anyone in this hall who wouldn't take the risk and get on a boat rather than hide in the shadows of Indonesia for 20 or 30 or 40 years? If there is anyone who wouldn't get on a boat, I'd be very interested to hear that. So they get on a boat. I've never, by the way, I've never met any Australian who said that they wouldn't get on a boat. But the curious thing is that the ones who get on a boat at the great risk to themselves, those are the ones we vilify. They're the ones we pick on. They're the ones we mistreat. And yet, over the last 15 years, more than 90% of boat people have ultimately been assessed by our system as refugees legally entitled to our protection. So here's the curiosity that someone might like to explain to me later. The people who arrive here who are least likely to be refugees are the ones who are allowed to remain in the community for the whole time they're here. The ones who are overwhelmingly likely to be genuine refugees entitled to protection get locked up, mistreated and vilified publicly. Where's the sense in that? Now, when I say vilified and mistreated, it's really quite terrible what we actually do to those people. First of all, they arrive typically at Christmas Island, which is an island off to the northwest of Australia, closer to Jakarta than it is to the Australian coast. When they arrive there, they've typically been on a boat for 6 or 7 days. They're typically in a very bad condition physically because, first of all, most of them come from landlocked countries, so they've never been on an ocean before. And second, they've been held in very uncomfortable conditions on the boat, and many of them suffer seasickness. They've mostly not had enough to eat or drink. They've had no opportunity to wash or to change their clothes. And so they arrive in Christmas Island in filth, literally in filth, in their own filth, and they're not even allowed the dignity of being able to wash themselves and change before they're interviewed by the immigration department. If the immigration department then brings in doctors who are employed by the department, the doctor's role is to see whether a person is eligible for moving offshore to Nauru or to Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, or whether they're eligible for detention in a detention centre on the mainland, or whether they should remain in detention on Christmas Island. The way they're treated in detention is a national disgrace. I should tell you that the law in Australia says that a person who is not a citizen, who does not have a visa, must be detained and remain in detention until they get a visa or until they're removed from Australia. That's the mandatory detention system. And that means that they may be held in detention for months or years, and no one can ever tell them how long they'll be there. And this indefinite detention idea, we tend to forget about it, but indefinite detention means what it says. It means you could never know when it will end. And the rather simple provisions that provide for indefinite detention, mandatory detention, came under scrutiny in an important case in the High Court in 2003. There was a man called Ahmed Al-Khateb who had arrived in Australia seeking asylum. So he's a non-citizen. He didn't have a visa. He came as a boat person. And so he was detained. And he was initially rejected in his claim for refugee status. He knew that he could appeal that. He knew that appealing it would likely succeed, but would also extend his time in detention for as much as 12 or 18 months. And so he said, "I can't bear it in detention any longer. Please remove me from Australia." So there's only two ways out of detention. One is to get a visa and the other is to be removed from Australia. So he said, "Just remove me from Australia." But they couldn't. The reason they couldn't was that he is a stateless Kuwaiti and there was no country to which he could be sent. So there was a conundrum. Here we've got a person who has only two ways out of detention. He hasn't committed any offence. He's not a risk to anyone. But the Act says he has to be detained until he gets a visa. That's refused. Or until he's removed from Australia, and that's not possible. So what did the Australian government do, do you think? The Australian government argued all the way to the High Court that that man could remain in detention for the rest of his life. And by a majority of 4 votes to 3, the High Court held that that is what the Act means, and with that meaning, it was constitutionally valid. Now, I address myself especially to the students over in that corner of the hall where I can't see you anymore. Imagine what it must be like to be told that although you've done nothing wrong, although you aren't a risk to anyone, you will have to remain in hellish detention for the rest of your life, simply because there's nowhere else we can send you. It's a disgraceful political position to have adopted, and it's a disgrace that any government in this country would have suffer a number of indignities. The first is their clothes are taken from them and they're then reissued with some new clothes. Well, that's not bad when you consider. But if they have any medical devices, hearing aids, spectacles, prosthetic limbs, or anything of that sort, they're confiscated and not returned. So you have people with a missing limb who have their artificial limb taken from them. If they have any medications on them, those medications are confiscated. And one person has a pretty much full-time job standing over a bucket, popping pills out of blister packs, and then disposing of those pills. If the refugees have any medical documentation with them, doctor's letters, prescriptions or the like, those are confiscated and not returned. What that means is that people with immediate medical needs are placed in a position where they are not able to have their medical needs met. Their medication has been taken and no one knows what's wrong with them, and it will take some time to find out. Now, this has been illustrated in numerous individual cases, but a couple that come to mind. A man in his middle age who was showing signs of quite erratic behaviour in detention on Christmas Island. He was apparently suffering terrible headaches and he was becoming increasingly distressed in his conduct. It turned out that he had extremely bad vision, but his glasses had been taken from him when he arrived. He couldn't see properly, and his vision difficulties were giving him migraine headaches, which were driving him crazy. All he needed was his glasses, but they'd been taken from him because he'd arrived wearing glasses. Another, one doctor who contacted me from Christmas Island told me about a woman from the Middle East who she was interviewing. The woman had been on Christmas Island for a few weeks and was showing signs of very erratic, bizarre behaviour. No one could work out what the problem was. The doctor interviewed her. They have a sort of statutory 10-minute interview. But by the end of 10 minutes, she hadn't been able to work out what was wrong. The reason? Well, although they're sitting across the desk from each other, the interpreter was in Sydney at the other end of a telephone. Not a very good way to conduct a difficult medical examination. Anyway, the doctor managed to persuade the department officials that she should be allowed to have more than 10 minutes to discuss things with this woman in order to find out what the problem was. And eventually she worked out that the problem was that this lady was incontinent of urine and she had no underwear. So whenever she got up to walk around the camp, she would have urine running down her leg, and the humiliation of it was driving her mad. And so she sat in her room all day, all night. She was not willing to get up and move around because it was so embarrassing for her. The doctor immediately spoke to the department officials and said, "We need incontinence pads for this lady." They said, "We don't do those," and they were prepared to refuse to provide them until the doctor insisted. And so the department then reluctantly agreed to provide 4 incontinence pads per day. Not enough. The lady has to queue up when she needs more. But at least it relieved the immediate embarrassment and humiliation for her. And as soon as that was dealt with, her behaviour transformed. Now, these are cruelties and humiliations which no decent country should ever inflict on anyone for any reason whatever, and especially on people who've committed no offence and have done nothing worse than to arrive here and ask for our protection. So, that's Christmas Island. Onshore detention has its problems. When people are found to be eligible for onshore detention, what happens is that they're placed in the notorious detention centres. You've all seen images of them on the news, razor wire, guards, all that sort of thing. And they are held there for however long it takes. No one can actually tell them. Now, it's an interesting thing. As a matter of psychology, if you lock up an innocent person for long enough, they will eventually fall into despair and hopelessness. How long it takes depends on circumstances. During the early 2000s, the psychiatrists who say that indefinite detention is toxic and inevitably causes mental disabilities, they observed that it took between 12 to 18 months, typically, before people began to fall into hopelessness and start self-harming. this time round, Australia seems to have rather improved on its previous record, because now people sent to Nauru or Manus Island are falling into hopelessness and despair and self-harm in just 9 months. We've managed to make them feel so bad about the conditions in which they're held. So offshore detention has horrors that onshore detention doesn't have. Onshore detention, bad enough, is a bit of a story. It's probably a little bit off my topic, but some of you will remember hearing about a detention centre in South Australia called Baxter Detention Centre. It was designed for the Howard government in 2003 or thereabouts, and it was built for them to their design, and it opened, I think, in August of 2004. Now, Baxter Immigration Detention Centre is a modern high-tech prison. It's an enormous structure. It's out in the desert, and if you stand outside Baxter and look to the east, you're looking at a perfect Fred Williams landscape. If you turn west, you see a glittering, shining row of wire fences. And inside two layers of wire fences, there are the buildings where the people are accommodated, but all the buildings look inwards. There is no window that looks outwards to the Australian desert. People inside it never see the Australian desert. They only see each other. Now, I have been invited to give a talk or take part in a panel session in South Australia in the middle of 2004, just before Baxter opened. And it happened that a copy of the ground plan of the Baxter Immigration Detention Centre fell off the back of a truck and floated ever so gently onto my desk. And that was useful because I was able to see the way it had been designed and form a few views about why it had been designed like that. I mean, it really is like a high-tech prison. One of the other people on the panel was a very senior member of the Department of Immigration. She was in charge of the onshore compliance group, which is the Lock 'em Up Brigade. And so, taking advantage of her presence and the audience there, I asked her publicly in front of the audience why it was that the outside perimeter fence on the ground plan, an electric fence, was described as a courtesy fence. Because it didn't seem to me very courteous to try to electrocute people, either people trying to get out or people trying to get in. And she stared at me and said, "It's not an electric fence. It's an energized fence." I thought, you know, you've got to be a very special character to find some sense of comfort in locking people up behind an electric fence, because you can call it an energized fence, a 9,000-volt energized fence. That's the way we treat people who've committed no offense whatever. Anyway, it gives you a clue, though, to the way in which the system has reacted against asylum seekers. Now, during 2001, the then Howard government introduced offshore detention, specifically using Nauru, which is a small republic in the Pacific Ocean, and Manus Island, which is an island part of Papua New Guinea, north of the main island of Papua New Guinea. Now, Nauru is an important place to bear in mind. Nauru is 21 square kilometres in size. It's probably smaller. It would probably fit into Preston. I'm pretty confident it would, actually. It has a population of 10,000 people, or somewhat less. It has no measurable gross domestic product. It is a bankrupt island nation. Not surprisingly, when Australia offered to throw millions of dollars at it, it jumped at the opportunity to warehouse refugees on our account. The problem is that people held in Nauru are held helplessly in incredibly hard conditions, and recent arrivals there have been told that the length of their stay will depend on how the no advantage principle operates in their case. But they're told informally, you can expect to be here for about 5 years, living under canvas, in 50-degree heat, with mosquitoes and inadequate water, inadequate electricity, inadequate everything. They are being persuaded to lose hope very, very fast. problem, an additional problem with Nauru is that very recently the rule of law in Nauru has completely broken down. Nauru, to its credit, has got a modern constitution, unlike ours, and it's got a constitutional bill of rights, unlike ours. The constitutional bill of rights includes a guarantee of personal liberty and very, very good things like that. But no bill of rights is going to help people unless the rule of law survives. And the rule of law for this purpose just means the executive government of the day obeys the laws of the land. And if someone has a problem, they're able to go to the courts and get that problem dealt with fairly and justly as a matter of law. Now, some of you will have read in the news that recently there's been some problems in Nauru. Nauru, being a small country, has only one magistrate and one judge. The magistrate made a decision in relation to some asylum seekers which the government didn't like. He's an Australian, so they decided to deport him. So much for judicial independence. When the Chief Justice of Nauru, the only Supreme Court judge, who's also an Australian, lives in Melbourne, a former Supreme Court judge of the Supreme Court of Victoria, he heard about this and issued an injunction ordering the Nauruan government not to deport the magistrate. But the government of Nauru deported the magistrate anyway. They simply defied an order of the Supreme Court. So the Chief Justice of Nauru tried to go back to Nauru to try and sort things out. And the government of Nauru cancelled his visa. They've actually locked out their own Chief Justice. Now, that's a country where the rule of law has truly failed. So that means that when people's asylum claims are processed on Nauru, their access to the court to challenge adverse decisions is meaningless because the court system isn't working. If they try to enforce their constitutional rights of freedom, etc., it's meaningless because the court system isn't working. That's what it is to be in a country where the rule of law has broken down. Interestingly, although Australia is very often quite vocal about Pacific Island nations that misbehave, because it's in our interest as a country to make sure that neighbouring countries behave themselves properly, our government has been conspicuously silent about the breakdown of the rule of law in Nauru. And the reason for that, I suspect, is this. Australia wants asylum seekers in Nauru to lose hope. They want asylum seekers in Nauru to fear what will happen to them. They want asylum seekers in Nauru to give up the game and choose to go back to wherever they came from and face whatever persecution they were fleeing. In Manus Island, the problem is similar but somewhat different, and you all will have seen recently that there was a riot in the detention centre in Manus Island. Initially, the story was that the people held there, the detainees held there, had broken out and gone on a rampage. Well, of course, that's a brilliant way for the government to spin the thing, but as it turns out, the truth was that PNG locals broke into the detention centre and started beating up the detainees. And we've got an eyewitness account from one of them, who was a roommate of a bloke called Reza Barati, and this guy has given evidence that a PNG local who might have been a guard employed by the detention service, but we're not entirely sure, this guy had something like a cricket bat with two long nails driven right through it. And he started hitting Reza Barati with this, lacerated his scalp terribly, managed to get him onto the ground. Someone then jumped on his head, and according to this witness, that killed him, because the next thing is someone hit Reza Barati's body with a stick, and he didn't flinch. And that's why the witness knew that Barati was dead. So far, no one has been charged, even though there have been lots of witnesses recently found by an Australian barrister who went there from Sydney. None of these witnesses have been spoken to by the PNG police. None of them have been spoken to by anyone on behalf of Australia. The whole thing is being left in the corner. Until, to his great credit, a bloke called David Cannings, a judge of the PNG Supreme Court, exercised his constitutional power to decide to undertake an investigation of his own motion in order to see what had gone on. He started investigating what had gone on, and the government of Papua New Guinea issued an injunction to stop him in his investigation. So he then issued, he then started a fresh investigation, and now they've stopped that investigation. Australia, again, has said nothing critical of the PNG government. It suits Australia very well to make sure that anyone sent to PNG or to Nauru lives in dread of their fate, so that they will give up their claim for protection and will prefer to go back to the country they came from. Now, I think you need to understand very carefully. You will have heard, some of you at least will have heard on the news, that the present government is operating what it calls a system of deterrence. They want to deter people from coming to Australia. They claim that they want to deter people from coming to Australia by boat because they're worried about them drowning. Well, forgive my language, but that's bullshit. They really don't care that people drown on their way to Australia. If they cared about people drowning on their way to Australia, they would have set up a processing centre in Indonesia so that people could be processed there and could be safely resettled from there. They don't care about people drowning at all. They are so callous in their disregard for the human rights of asylum seekers that they really don't care if they drown. What they don't want is them getting here. Now, the fact that they are trying to stop them from coming is backed by or explained by their so-called policy of deterrence. They say they're deterring people from drowning, but it's interesting to notice that the risk of drowning isn't enough to stop people trying to seek safety in Australia. And maybe that's not surprising when you consider the horrors they're fleeing. So what Australia is doing is trying to make detention in Australia look so awful that, added to the risk of drowning, people would prefer to stand their ground and face down the Taliban or the genocidal regime in Sri Lanka than face the Australian way of dealing with refugees. Now, I would ask all of you to reflect seriously on this. Do you really want this to be a country which behaves so badly towards refugees that people would rather be killed by the Taliban than come here for safety? That's not the country I want to live in. It's certainly not the country I grew up in. How have they got away with this? I mean, it's breathtaking when you see the cruelty with which we're behaving. When you see the extraordinary cost of this exercise, it's just astounding that taxpayers put up with it. Let me give you an illustration. The numbers of boat people coming to Australia vary, obviously, from year to year. Long-term average is something like 1,000 or 2,000 people a year, not a big number. In 2001, the year of the Tampa episode, the number peaked. We got just over 4,000 boat people that year, which is not really a very big number when you consider we take 200,000 new migrants every year, or we take 4.5 million tourists and students and so on each year. Anyway, it was just over 4,000 in 2001. In 2012, the number spiked to 25,000. We had just over 25,000 boat people arrive in 2012. It was back to the figures that we had after the Vietnam War. But that number has fallen away again. So I wonder, how much would that sort of arrival rate cost us? I want you to imagine for a moment that Australia suddenly began acting decently. I want you to imagine for a moment that instead of locking them up indefinitely or shipping them off to places like Nauru or PNG, we decided instead we'd treat them like human beings. And after an initial, perhaps 1 month in detention for preliminary health and security checks, we'd let them into the community. We'd let them work. We'd let them have access to Centrelink and Medicare benefits. We'd make sure they stayed in touch with the department so they can't just disappear. And I would add a condition that until their refugee status is decided, they must live in a specified regional area. And let's suppose we did that. And let's suppose every single one of them remained on Centrelink, full Centrelink benefits for the whole time it took to assess their claim for protection. That would cost us, if the 2012 figures remained, although they don't, that would cost us $500 million a year. I wonder how many people realise that at the moment, to deal with a smaller number of people, we're spending $5 billion a year. $5 billion $4.5 billion a year. $4.5 billion a year more than it would cost to treat them decently. Now, the interesting thing about having them all stay in regional areas pending refugee status assessment is that all of that $500 million, assuming none of them got a job, assuming they all stayed on Centrelink benefits, the whole $500 million each year would be spent in the failing economies of country towns that are failing because they're losing population to the cities. There would be an immense benefit to rural Australia. There'd be an immense benefit to refugees who, instead of being mistreated and driven to hopelessness and self-harm, would be welcomed into the community and allowed to be productive. It's just a thought. And it may be that if we can't see that decency is right for its own sake, that saving $4.5 billion a year wouldn't be such a bad thing. Fantastic news today. Unbelievable. The government has now decided that refugees who come here are no longer entitled to get free legal assistance as they deal with the immigration refugee status process. It's a complicated process. I don't relish the idea of coming to a country with no language of that country and then having to negotiate my way through the labyrinthine interstices of the immigration system in order to demonstrate that I was entitled to be protected. And to do all of that without legal help. The government is crowing because this measure will save $25 million a year whilst they waste $5 billion a year on that same group of people. It's insane. Why have they got away with this? Why do we tolerate it? I actually think Australia's pretty good people. Why are we tolerating it? And I think the answer is this. They've been demonised relentlessly since the middle of 2001. In 2001, the then government started calling them illegals. Although it's a lie, they haven't broken any law by coming here without papers, without a visa, without an invitation. They don't break any law. They don't commit any offence. They were called queue jumpers, but there isn't a queue. There's an interesting thing about that. Just imagine for a minute. Let's suppose you come from Afghanistan, and more than half of the refugees who've come here as boat people in the last 15 years have been Hazaras from Afghanistan, a seriously persecuted group. 99% of Hazaras who've made it to Australia are ultimately assessed by us as refugees legally entitled to protection. They are equivalent now to the Jews of Europe in the 1930s. They are persecuted. And all they have to do is get here to prove that they're persecuted, and they would get refugee protection. But let's suppose you've got a punctilious Hazara in Afghanistan. And he's heard Tony Abbott going on about coming in the back door, coming in the front door. So he decides, I won't be a queue jumper. I will go and get a visa. Well, how do you do that? You probably look at the DFAT website and see whereabouts the consular office is in Kabul. So you do that. I challenge you. Do it tonight when you get home. Go onto the DFAT website and look for the address of the Australian consulate in Kabul. And you'll be told on the DFAT website that the address of the Australian consulate in Kabul is a secret for security reasons. What sort of queue is it when you're not even allowed to know the address? It's insane. And why is it that we live in this fantasy world that says that the etiquette of the checkout queue at Woolworths is the same etiquette that governs you when you're running for your life? No refugee in history has ever thought that there is such a thing as a queue to stand in whilst your persecutors try and kill you. They were accused of throwing their children into the sea. The Children Overboard affair in late 2001 was a national disgrace, which turned out, after a Senate inquiry, to be utterly false. In the last 12 or 18 months, our present minister, Scott Morrison, for whom, let me say, I have unbridled contempt, Scott Morrison said that if asylum seekers are to be housed in the community, they shouldn't be placed near children or vulnerable people, and they should be required to report to the police regularly. What's the message that comes from this? The message that comes from it is these are dangerous criminals, and it's a lie. Why would the government lie about the character of the people who come asking for our help? Because it gives them a chance to demonise them and then mistreat them and makes the public think that they're doing these people have been falsely demonized, dishonestly demonized, so that they can be mistreated. Now, let me make it very clear. If it were the case that asylum seekers, boat people, were dangerous criminals, I would applaud the government for protecting us from them. I would applaud the government for doing whatever it can to make sure that none of them get here. But it's a lie, and it looks very different when you realise that this is being done not to dangerous criminals, but to terrified individual human beings fleeing horrors of a sort we can scarcely imagine. Let me tell you a single story to stand for the whole. In 2001, I think, my wife Kate set up a thing called Spare Rooms for Refugees. Her theory was this hostile attitude to refugees is just not the way most Australians are. Most Australian houses have a spare room because kids have grown up and left home and all that. And offering someone a spare room is a mark of characteristic Australian generosity. And so she said, we should campaign to get people volunteering spare rooms free of charge to asylum seekers. And so we set that up. But of course we had to lead by example, so we've had refugees living with us since 2001. And a very good thing it is too, by the way. The third or fourth refugee lived with us was a kid. It's the only youngster who's come our way. He was 11, I think, when he arrived at our place. And we've put him through primary school and secondary school, and now we're putting him through university. For the first couple of months of his stay with us, Musa was sort of downloading everything from his past. He would just stand in the kitchen whilst Kate was making dinner and just tell stories about his past. It was quite unusual. And one day he said, oh, you know, when I was 8, it was my job in the family to look after the sheep, and so I'd just take the sheep up the hill every day and I'd look after them. It's pretty boring just standing up the hill with the sheep, because sheep aren't all that really interesting. And he said, and one day my friend came up so we could play around, and he came up and he saw something interesting between some rocks, and it was bright yellow and shiny, and he couldn't reach it with his hand, so he got a stick, but it exploded and his arm came off. And I went down to get his mother, but when we got back, he was dead. So the next day I took the dog up, and I was playing around with the dog. And the day after that, this, and the day after that, something else. Just, you know, one day my friend got killed. That was just another day in his existence as a child. You know, I mean, how many eight-year-olds do you know who've seen their friend killed by an unexploded device in between the rocks? And yet for him it was just one of those things that happens. That's the sort of stuff that we simply don't understand. It would be ludicrous to think of someone like Musa as a dangerous criminal. We've got more than 1,000 children in immigration detention. Can anyone seriously suggest that they're dangerous criminals, that we need to be protected from them? And yet Mr. Morrison has renamed the Department of Immigration and Citizenship the Department of Immigration and Border Protection. Well, I think we need to be protected from politicians like him. We do not need to be protected from refugees who are brave enough to risk their lives at sea trying to get to a place of safety, having fled horrors we can scarcely imagine. But the government has misled us. The government has misled us so that we tolerate and even applaud the mistreatment of innocent human beings. The low point of this trajectory was seen last September during the federal election, where both major parties, let me make it very clear, in attacking the government for what they're doing now, I'm not singling out the Liberals as especially wicked, although I think they are especially wicked in their conduct. The Labor Party has been equally bad. The Labor Party has never taken the opportunity, either in government or in opposition, to say it's all a lie. You've been misled. They're not illegal. They're not dangerous. They're not people we need to be protected from. It takes a political leader to be able to say that and get through to the public at large. They haven't done it. The Labor Party are complicit in this whole operation as much as the Coalition. So my criticisms, although directed at Scott Morrison at the moment, can be applied equally to the opposition. Last September demonstrated this. Last September, if you recall, a substantial part of the electioneering by both major parties was an attempt by them to out-promise each other in the cruelty with which they would treat innocent human beings. It has never happened before in Australia's political history. Imagine if they'd been promising cruelty to animals. That wouldn't have worked. Imagine if they'd been promising cruelty to Jews. That would have been a bit on the nose. But cruelty to boat people, let it rip. That was what Australia came to in September last year. A competition to outbid each other in promises of cruelty to a group of human beings who committed no offence. Now, my question for you tonight, in memory of Santo Costanzo, is this. Is that conduct of our government a true reflection of what we are as a society? If it is, it's something that we should all lament. I personally do not believe that we are as cruel and selfish as our government's conduct would make us seem. But, and consider the alternative. Have a look at Greece. I mean, what, 12, 15 months ago, when the Syrian conflict erupted, Greece, with a population half that of Australia's and an economy that's in a bit of trouble, Greece volunteered to take 20,000 Syrian refugees in one go because Greece was decent enough to see that people needed help. And that's what refugee movement are about. It's people needing help. And I think Australia, unless deceived by politicians, is the sort of country that would voluntarily help people. We've done it in other contexts at other times. I think Australia is a decent country. But now you know how we've been misled. And I want to remind you of something that was once said by Arundhati Roy. Arundhati Roy is known in Australia as the author of a Booker Prize-winning novel called The God of Small Things. She's best known in India, where she comes from, as a political activist. And in one of her political essays, Arundhati Roy said, "A thing once seen cannot be unseen. And when you've seen a great moral wrong, to remain silent is as much a political act as to speak against it." You all know now the terrible moral wrong that we are carrying out on boat people. The terrible, terrible moral crime of which this country is guilty. And you can't unknow it. You're stuck with that knowledge, and you have a choice. You have a choice to fall in line with it and allow it to happen and keep happening in your name, or to speak up in whatever way is available to you and oppose it. And I just finish by asking you this. Reflect on what you've heard tonight said about Santo Costanzo. Reflect on what some of you, at least, know of him by your friendship with him. What would he do if he saw this country behaving this badly? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Burnside, for that insightful and considered presentation. I would now like to call on the Chair of the new Board of Directors, His Grace Bishop Iacobus.
Thank you, Denise. It falls to me, dear friends, to offer the vote of thanks and the blaring spotlights, which means that I must be honest, at this very auspicious occasion, on behalf of His Eminence, our Archbishop Stylianos, of the new board of St. John's, and we will be new up until our first year anniversary, which is July 3rd. After that will be the board. On behalf of our school leadership and staff, our students and our past students and their families, on the occasion of the inaugural memorial congregation dedicated to a much beloved member of the faculty of St. John's, Santa Costanzo, who, as we heard this evening, for those of us who do not have the privilege to know him, to work with him, or to be taught by him, an outstanding gentleman of high moral character, a man who would be honored and probably embarrassed this evening. However, he would and has made his family proud, his biological family and his spiritual family, the family of St. John's. May his memory be eternal. And to honour him and to offer all of us the value, the prestige of this event, the board, and especially Mr. Bill Yavris, graciously invited, and you have spoiled us, sir, Mr. Burnside, for accepting so generously this invitation to attend and to offer the oration, the first oration at our school, in the wider Greek community. I think this is the first time you may have spoken in the Greek community. Maybe? Yes, no? Okay, we don't want to claim all the prestige, but definitely tonight. And you have in the topic, in the theme, in that which is so dear to your heart and your person, which does honor you, to speak of human rights and to actively take up the challenge to come out of your own safe and comfortable environment, to turn a blind eye and just leave things as they are, to accept that which is being propagated. You stand as a voice in the wilderness and you inspire. You speak the truth in love and you remind us of human rights, which are global. They're not just to one particular ethnic background, but they are rights of all humans, for dignity, for peace, for safety, for the chance at life. And in doing so, you remind us also of human responsibilities. And it's on this point that you brought together so well at the end of your talk, the responsibility that each one of us has, whether we are those who vote for our governments or those who are becoming the voters of the future. We are all citizens here. We are all have some ethnic or migrant story in our own lives. And we can remember fondly how, through the passage of time, we have become accepted, and that this country has a very warm heart to offer those in need. It seems to have been forgotten of late, but we need to find that again. And it is not only mandated by international law, but it's mandated by God himself that we treat each other with love as we would treat and expect to be treated ourselves. So, on behalf of everyone here, on behalf of the entire St. John's College, I offer the deepest gratitude and thank you. Thank you for attending and inspiring us and reminding us of these basic principles which we espouse, but which we must live by as well and act. And strength to continue, and may he bless the work of your hands. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you, Your Grace. I would now like to call on the Principal, Dr. Lodopoulos, and our two school captains to present a gift on behalf of the College and the Board of Directors in appreciation to Mr. Burnside. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our proceedings this evening. Tea and coffee and cool drinks will be available either in the foyer or the canteen servery. And thank you very much for attending tonight.